First, those of us who are concerned with these things professionally find that although most practicing barristers know they're bound by a code of professional conduct, or for that matter solicitors, to whom I shall return in a moment, very few have actually read it or know what it involves. The consequences of a finding of professional misconduct against a barrister are serious. The finding stays on his or her record for good, and for the sake of simplicity and elegance, the masculine includes the feminine for the rest of the evening, as far as I'm concerned. It stays on his record for good. The Bar Standards Board, to whom we shall return later, doesn't hold with newfangled ideas like spent convictions or anything like that. So the fact of a finding of professional misconduct will be taken into consideration if the barrister applies for preferment later in life to, say, Silk or to the bench. Unsurprisingly, most of what I've got to say this evening applies to the bar rather than solicitors, because my working life's been spent there and I'm most familiar with its rules. However, the underlying principles apply to solicitors, as one would expect as a branch of what is still an honourable profession, in spite of what you read and hear in the media. This, I think, will become even more true as the number of solicitor advocates licensed to appear in the higher courts continues to increase, and as ex-solicitors reach high judicial office, there's now at least one on the bench of the Supreme Court. Today, the main factor which distinguishes the barrister's work from that of the solicitor is money, in more ways than one. There remains, as there has been, I think, since time immemorial, an absolute embargo on a barrister having access to his lay client's funds. By contrast, solicitors must necessarily handle clients' money, and much of the regulatory code to which they are subject is designed to ensure that those funds are properly managed. I don't profess to even begin to understand the rules that govern solicitors' accounts, and they seem to be directed, so far as I can tell, to ensuring that solicitors don't defraud their clients or the public. As yet, the bar is not happily exposed to such temptations, but it's been indicated that the management is considering exposing us to handling clients' money as a consequence of what is going to be called direct access. If that happens, I would see it probably as another and perhaps decisive step on the way to the fusion of the branches of the profession. I don't care to say on this occasion, at least, whether that's a development that's to be welcomed or lamented. 50 years ago, Mr. R.E. McGarry, QC, later Vice Chancellor of McGarry, and also late of this parish, as it happens, wrote in the course of his Hamlin Lectures in 1962, "The bar is a small and honourable profession, and with rare exceptions, the rules are honourably and loyally observed. Once the word gets round, and the practising bar is small and concentrated, the bar is watchful, and sooner rather than later, consequences are likely to follow. Above all, there's the atmosphere of chambers, of hall, and of the circuit mess. At the beginning of 1961, of a little over 1,900 practicing barristers, some 80 were in chambers of 3 or less, and some 210 in chambers of 14 to 17 inclusive. Some 85% of the bar accordingly practice in chambers of not less than 4, nor more than 13, with 7 as the most popular number. Nor, incidentally, do practicing barristers have visiting cards or notepaper which discloses their status." That description brings a wry smile to the lips 50 years on. In 2010, which is the last year for which the figures are available, the practicing bar numbered 12,420, 32% of whom were women, 500 came from the Indian subcontinent, 100 were other Asian, and 130 African. A set of chambers in London with 7 members, let alone 3, would now be thought laughably small and probably unworkable given the size of the overheads. And that's true of most of the other big cities in the country outside the capital. My own chambers, for example, 6 months ago, when I wrote the text of this, had 74 barrister members, of whom 22 were silks, supported by 10 clerks and 19 administrative staff, including accountants, marketing specialists, an IT manager, a doorman come bouncer, and receptionist, now promoted to conference manager. That was 6 months ago. Now the number is nearer 90, because another set of chambers in London has imploded, and its members have been scattered to the winds of heaven, and a number have washed up at our door, and we've been glad to take them. I think it's 87, but it was probably 85 this morning, and has gone up since. Until relatively recently, every member of the bar had to have a clerk and to practice from premises dedicated as professional chambers. Now, counsel are permitted to practice from their homes, off the piano in the parlour, as it were, without a clerk, to negotiate their own fees, and an increasingly large number take advantage of these privileges. Furthermore, the rule forbidding barristers from accepting instructions from anyone other than a solicitor has been relaxed, although not repealed in toto, as I shall show. All this means that the code of conduct has been drastically revised over the years to reflect the changes in the bar. Even so, the ethos described by Ted McGarry, with perhaps a hint of complacency, survives, as do the fundamental rules, albeit somewhat changed. A word or two about the history. Historically, the four inns of court operated very much like particularly intemperate and unruly Oxbridge colleges, if you read the minutes of Parliament. They all seem to be getting into trouble. But they educated young men for the law and for the court, whereas Oxford and Cambridge, as I'm sure you all know, tended to educate for the church. The result is that, historically, the four inns were responsible for the discipline of their own members, and a pretty poor fist they made of it. I won't go into details, but effectively, the trials of barristers who got into trouble were little better than kangaroo courts, with no vestige of obeisance in the direction of what we now know as human rights and fair trials. But I won't weary you with the details of that. At present, though, the discipline of the profession, and I include both branches in that, is regulated by a thing called the Legal Services Act 2007. Under it, what one might call the trades union functions of the bar remain the responsibility of the Bar Council. Discipline is now in the hands of the Bar Standards Board, which I mentioned a few moments ago. This consists partly of barristers and partly of laymen and women, which is chaired for the moment by an academic lawyer from Oxford, I hasten to add. This brings proceedings against barristers who are alleged to have infringed the code of conduct, and resolution of these proceedings is entrusted to a body called the Council of the Inns of Court, which appoints disciplinary tribunals. These sit in boards of three, sometimes in more serious cases, five members, none of whom is a member of the Bar Council or the Bar Standards Board. They consist of barristers and lay people, and there must always be at least one lay member of any tribunal. And there's a right of appeal from these tribunals to a body called the Visitors of the Inns of Court, in effect, the judges of the High Court. The visitors generally sit in threes, with a High Court judge or a Court of Appeal judge as chairman, one barrister member, and one layman. The disciplinary machinery for solicitors is pretty different. It used to be entrusted to the Law Society, but it's now in the hands of something called the Solicitors Regulation Authority, and it functions in very much the same way as the councils at the Inns of Court. I move on to the general principles which regulate professional ethics. From the day he joins an inn, the fledgling barrister finds himself under pretty rigorous scrutiny. Admission to an inn is vouchsafed only to a person of, quote, good character, And while a criminal conviction will not of itself be a disqualification, one for dishonesty almost certainly will, and will in any case be closely investigated. Once he's achieved call and started in practice, a daunting couple of tasks, as some of you will no doubt find out before too long. And because competition for pupillage and a fortiori for a seat in chambers is intense and getting intenser as the days pass, the barrister is confronted by a daunting catalogue of do's and don'ts. And for present purposes, I don't make any distinction between a self-employed barrister in private practice and one who is employed, except in one important respect. A self-employed barrister may not undertake the general conduct of a client's affairs or conduct litigation or correspondence with other parties. In short, he may only do the work traditionally associated with that of a barrister and not that of a solicitor. The lines, as in so many other things in this field, are becoming somewhat blurred. In circumstances which I confess I don't understand, barristers are now entitled to take statements from witnesses which would have been regarded as anathema up till about 3 years ago. For my part, I would think long and hard before I ventured to do any such thing, because of course the risk of you being accused of coaching the evidence is absolutely overwhelming, and it seems to me that the sensible barrister would stay well away from any such activity. In any case, there's a better justification for the rule, which is that an advocate's time is better part on the forensic part of the case, which in all conscience is difficult enough, than rather than in the relatively routine task of assembling the evidence. An employed barrister is in a different position. He can supply advice. He can conduct litigation on behalf of his employer. And if he works for a government department, he can do so for the minister of the department which employs him. If you ever have occasion to look at the Code of Conduct, you'll find that it is infamously obscure in its drafting and shot through with ambiguities and difficulties. I could spend the rest of the evening going through them, but I think you'd find it wearisome, and I certainly should. But there's one recent development that I should draw to your attention. It's this. The rule that, as I hinted a moment ago, that a barrister may only act if he's instructed by a solicitor, has now been relaxed so that he may be instructed by a limited number of professionals. And this is called direct professional access. There are people like accountants who instruct the tax bar. Engineers instruct the construction and engineering bar. Architects and town planners instruct the planning bar, and so on. And as I've said, and I won't go into the details, the public access rules provide for direct access by a lay client to a barrister, subject to stringent safeguards about the client's money, which has to be paid into a separate account, and also the barrister has to retain the documents for, I think, 7 years, which, as those of you who become solicitors will find, is one of the more onerous obligations which rests upon a solicitor's firm under the Law Society's rules. I believe that there are large London firms who rent entire warehouses in the London suburbs to store the documents, which are never looked at, except once in a blue moon, and because they're obliged to do so. Once in 7 years, they have a huge clear-out and a holocaust, no doubt. Now, the bedrock of the Bar Code of Conduct, you'll forget this, but I might as well mention it so that I can't be accused of overlooking it. It's paragraph 301 of the Code, and it says, and I'm quoting this verbatim, a barrister must not A, engage in conduct, whether in pursuit of his profession or otherwise, which is one, dishonest or otherwise discreditable to a barrister, two, prejudicial to the administration of justice, or three, likely to diminish public confidence in the legal profession or the administration of justice or otherwise bring the legal profession into disrepute. Emphasis is mine. On one view, here's one of the difficulties of the code of conduct that I touched on a moment ago. Those prohibitions are all encompassing. For instance, how does a barrister bring discredit on the bar otherwise than in the pursuit of his profession, and otherwise than dishonestly? I suppose if he were to supplement his income from practice by keeping a brothel, that would probably meet the requirement, because that's a criminal offence. But would membership of a sadomasochistic ring of consenting adults be a breach of the code of conduct? I just don't know. On one view, and I darkly suspect that the Bar Standards Board might share that view, it would. But so far as I'm aware, it's not as yet unlawful to employ one's leisure in such pursuits, at least in private. Or, and this is not a fanciful example, because it's one that I'm drawing on from my own experience, does it otherwise bring the profession into disrepute if a married barrister takes the opportunity while his wife is abroad to invite a young woman, or for that matter a young man, to his house with the intent, later implemented, of mounting an assault on his or her virtue? And as I say, that is a real-life case which resulted in an allegation of professional misconduct being brought against the married barrister in question, and I and a number of my colleagues acted for him. I'm happy to report that he was, in the end, exonerated, but, and here's the difficulty, only by a majority of the disciplinary tribunal. And the fact that the opinions were divided eloquently exposes the difficulty of applying the code of conduct to factual cases. There are other fundamental principles from which everything really derives. There's an overriding duty to act with independence in the interests of justice and to assist in the administration of justice and not deceive or knowingly or recklessly mislead the court, to prosecute the lay client's best interests without regard to his own interests, and not to permit absolute integrity, independence, and freedom from external pressures to be compromised. You, I think, might be astonished, but you won't be after a little exposure to practice, how much time we spend trying to dissuade litigants from pressing ahead with cases which they have little chance of winning, against, of course, our own financial interests. Going back to McGarry again, it's because if you get a reputation for encouraging people to take up hopeless cases, the word gets round, and bang goes your practice in a respectable sense. So it's, in a sense, it's against one's own interests, but in the long term, not really. There are a variety of ways in which one's professional conduct and behaviour can be determined. As you will have inferred, there's the straightforward disciplinary charge of breach of the code of conduct following a complaint made to the Bar Standards Board by a third party, often a disgruntled client or litigant, or brought by the board of its own motion. That happens, for example, if a member of the bar is convicted of a serious motoring offence other than speeding or parking. Then he's under an obligation to report that to the Bar Standards Board, and they will very often bring a charge of professional misconduct of their own motion in those circumstances. As I've already said, though these complaints, once they've been investigated by a layman called the Complaints Commissioner, who advises the Bar Standards Board, the allegedly errant barrister is brought before a disciplinary tribunal. The second possible route is an action for professional negligence brought by an aggrieved lay client who claims to have suffered financial loss as a result of professional negligence. And thirdly and last, the barrister may be the subject of what's known as a wasted costs order, which is made by the court on the application by a party who is not necessarily the barrister's client, but maybe his opponent, or occasionally made of the court's own motion, on the ground that the conduct has occasioned unnecessary expense to a litigant or to the public. It may appear superficially that a finding of professional negligence or a wasted costs order is less reprehensible than a finding of a professional misconduct. I doubt whether in practice it is, because as I said, the gossip mill churns round, and once it gets known that this one of these three has happened, the stigma is really very much the same. So it behoves the barrister to tread warily at all times. Well, so much for the generalities. A moment or two now, if I may, on application of those general principles to the real world by reference to actual cases. First and self-evidently, as I've already made plain, I hope, the court must not be actively misled. This can be done with ingenuity. On Guy Fawkes Night in 1958, a Mr. Meek, who was a paparazzo, was plying his trade in Trafalgar Square. It being bonfire night, there was, to put it no higher, certain unrest in that place. And Mr. Meek was there to photograph the goings-on. During the course of the evening, he was arrested by a Chief Inspector Fleming and other police officers. They arrested him on a charge of obstructing the police, took him to a nearby police station, only releasing him late in the night, some hours later. Mr. Meek said that he'd been subjected to violence, but the police defended that. They said that it was justified since he violently resisted arrest. 12 days later, Mr. Meek began proceedings against the Chief Inspector for assault and wrongful imprisonment. Just over 1 year after that, the defendant, the Chief Inspector, was convicted of two disciplinary offences under the police regulations, which both involved irregularities connected to trials in a magistrate's court, and he was demoted from Chief Inspector to Station Sergeant. By the time the trial of the paparazzo's action came on, this demotion was known to his solicitors and to the leading and junior counsel who appeared for him at the hearing. And advised by my learned friends, or at least one of them, as we shall see, the erstwhile Chief Inspector attended the hearing in plain clothes instead of in uniform, and normally officers wear uniform in court. All the other police officers who gave evidence did. His leading, and possibly also his junior counsel, addressed him throughout as Mr. Fleming, rather than by his rank, which, as I've said, was now Station Sergeant. In evidence in chief, he wasn't asked his name, rank, and number, as was and still is de rigueur with police witnesses. Counsel and the trial judge frequently referred to him as inspector or chief inspector, and his leading counsel repeatedly referred in the course of evidence and his submissions to the inspectors, ex-inspectors, progress through the ranks of the police without saying how far that progress had gone or how it had come to an end, with the intent of creating the impression that he was an upright and conscientious policeman. The case was heard by a judge and a jury, and the jury gave a verdict for the defence. The full story came out somehow, and Mr. Meek, the photographer, appealed and made a very unusual application to call fresh evidence to the Court of Appeal. Leave to do that is very, very seldom granted. The evidence, of course, was the history of the Chief Inspector's demotion and the antics of his counsel at the trial. Leave to call that evidence was given, and the leader, who really had been responsible for it all, in the face of protest by his junior and his instructing solicitors, was disciplined by his benches. I think he was suspended for 5 years, if I remember correctly. This was in the late 1950s, before the Bar Standards Board and the Council of the Inns of Court existed. As you can imagine, the case attracted a good deal of interest, and not only in the trade press, but in the Inns of Court, but it made the tabloids as well. An unusual feature of the proceedings, and you can find this in the law reports, is that the leader was completely candid about the preparation for the trial and what he'd done at it. And with the lead of the Court of Appeal, he made a statement in open court after the appeal had been allowed, in which he acknowledged that the deception, although he didn't call it that, as you may imagine, was his sole responsibility, that he'd created it only after anxious consideration, and this in spite of opposition from the other lawyers on his team. I find it, speaking for myself, striking that a very senior leader, that's what he was, and a specialist in criminal jurisdiction, could betray such a failure of judgment. But I suppose that shows yet again how complex and tricky these questions can be. I haven't yet so far referred to another important but seldom met principle, that a barrister must not devise facts which will assist in advancing his lay client's case, and he mustn't draft any document containing allegation of fraud unless he's clear instructions to make such an allegation and has before him reasonably credible material which, as it stands, establishes a prima facie case of fraud. That, as you will appreciate, doesn't entitle a member of the bar who makes an allegation of fraud in the pleadings to hide behind his client's instructions. He has an independent duty to satisfy himself that there is material to support the allegation. And the consequences can be dramatic and very potentially expensive, as emerges from another case that was decided in, I think, about 1961 or so. This was a case where two characters, neither of whom I think one would want to say the weekend with, seemed to have devised some sort of television quiz game associated with snooker, the details of which don't matter. In the end, they got the BBC to put this on the telly, and it met with some success, although they then fell out over their respective shares of the royalties and took to litigation in the High Court in the Chancery Division. There were lots of interlocutory hearings and appeals, and after some years rather than months, the defendant of this unsavoury piece of litigation served two witness statements which had been settled by junior counsel, alleging that the claimant, his solicitors, and also a firm of court shorthand writers had conspired to forge the transcripts of one of the original hearings. And the intention was to show that the claimant was A, dishonest, and B, in a much more favourable light than would otherwise have been the case. And together with leading counsel, the junior went on to set up other documents which repeated the claim, and they both signed those documents. The trial judge rejected the allegations with some emphasis, and that's putting it mildly. And the defendant then appealed. He was obviously one of the more difficult clients, since he withdrew his instructions from the solicitors and both counsel shortly before the hearing date of the appeal, and then reinstated them at the last minute. The Court of Appeal hearing, and this is very unusual, lasted 4 days, no less. After that, the appeal was dismissed, and counsel for the respondent claimant wasn't even called on, showing, of course, that the court thought that the allegation of fraud had no merit whatever. And the claimant's counsel then applied for a wasted costs order, and you remember what I said about them, against both counsel individually, personally, on the ground that they had improperly breached paragraph 606 of the Code of Conduct by making these unfounded, as it was said, allegations of fraud. And the consequences would have been very serious. There had been almost certainly disciplinary proceedings brought by the Bar Standards Board. The professional reputations of both counsel would have been in ruins, and probably their practices would have evaporated overnight. And they would have had to pay, or their insurers would have had to pay, the costs of all these hearings, which must have gone run into tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds by the time all this came about. And here I must digress for a moment. There's an absolutely unbreakable rule of law, as well as professional etiquette, that all communication between a lay client and his legal advisors for the purposes of litigation is and remains completely confidential. It's called legal professional privilege, which is an expression I don't doubt you will recognize. And although the counsel asked their client to waive his privilege, because the privilege is his, not the lawyer's, he refused to do so. As a result, they had to defend the wasted costs proceedings with really no weapons at all, since they weren't at liberty to divulge what material had caused them to make the allegations of fraud in the pleadings. And perhaps predictably, the Court of Appeal made wasted costs orders, upholding the trial judge had done the same. But it's interesting, at least if you're a legal gossip, as all barristers are, that the dissenting member of the Court of Appeal was a puny judge who was sitting, as they sometimes do, with two Lords Justices. Interestingly also, that puny judge now sits in the House of Lords, in the Supreme Court, as Lord Wilson, and neither of the Lords Justices was ever promoted to the Supreme Court. You can draw your own conclusions. Anyway, the House of Lords, I mean the House of Lords deliberately, because it was before the Supreme Court came into existence. The House of Lords came to the rescue of counsel, and there was a happy ending, because the House wasn't prepared to draw the inference, even though it knew nothing of the instructions which counsel had got, that there was nothing to justify the allegations. And it gave both counsel the benefit of the doubt, and the wasted costs order was quashed. And this bizarre tale went right on to the wire. After the speeches had been drafted, but before they were delivered in the House, the defendant, or perhaps his solicitor, wrote to the House authorities, saying that, after all, the defendant was prepared to waive his legal professional privilege, but their lordships were having none of it and refused to reopen the case. I suspect that they were, for understandable reasons, anxious not to have to rewrite their speeches. Well, that's a selection. Bear with me one moment, I mustn't overrun. That's a brief insight into the world in which you're going to find yourselves, if you're bold enough to either get called to the bar or admitted as solicitors. But before I shut up and give you a chance to ask questions, I must answer the frivolous question that I posed in the working title of this case, for the sake of your social lives, if for nothing else. You will undoubtedly be asked, as your president has presently observed, frequently at drinks and dinner parties, how can you defend a person whom you know to be guilty? The short answer is that you can't. But then one has to go on to make the annoying lawyer's qualification. It all depends what you mean by no. And let's take the Stephen Lawrence case, which quite well illustrates the point. And here is something from Moot one day, you may think. Before the trial of the second trial of these two defendants opened, there was general suspicion that they had been in the gang which had committed the crime, even though they'd been tried and acquitted. And you remember one of the tabloids, it doesn't matter which, but I think I can remember, actually printed a 3-inch headline on the front page saying, "These men are guilty," or words to that effect, with pictures of these two defendants. I hope and I imagine that it was got into very hot water for contempt of court for prejudging the outcome of the trial, but I can't remember. They had been acquitted, I think, on a private prosecution by the relatives of Stephen Lawrence. Even so, this is an echo of the Millie Dowler case as well. Although they were exceedingly unattractive people, they continued to deny their guilt. And even after the forensic evidence, which led to the retrial and ultimately their conviction, it didn't entitle counsel to refuse to act. They had, in the words of the Court of Appeal in another case, to soldier on, in spite of any distaste they may have felt for the individuals, and revulsion of the crime. And this is a consequence of what you will learn to call the cab rank rule. It is an unbreakable rule that if you are offered a case for a proper fee, which is within your field of expertise, you are bound to take it. You cannot choose as a member of the bar. Solicitors can, if they dislike the colour of a potential client's hair, or dislike the thought of acting for them, a solicitor can quite properly refuse to accept instructions. A barrister can't. In other words, we are treated as if we were on a cab rank with the light on. That's why it's called the cab rank rule. Coming back to my theme, the reason that it was perfectly proper for counsel to act for these two beauties was that they had asserted their innocence, no matter how implausibly, throughout. And there is just a chance always that a defendant who appears to be guilty is innocent. Remember, after all, the case of the Crown and Beck that led to the establishment of the Court of Criminal Appeal back in the early 20th century. Mr. Beck had been convicted, I think, two or three times of the same offence, but he was innocent. And it was a result of that gross miscarriage of justice that the Court of Criminal Appeal was established in, I think, 1907, or thereabouts. That's the answer to your interrogators at dinner and drinks parties, that there's no stigma. Everybody knows that you're just a hired mouth, and you shouldn't incur any odium, quite the opposite, if you carry on in the face of overwhelming odds, which is what my colleague, you'll remember, who had to defend Millie Dowler, this murderer, suffered. He was attacked by people who should have known very much better for taking the case, because he had, if I remember correctly, on instructions to put to this unhappy girl's father, unhappy father too, that he, the father, had abused her, and that's why she ran away from home and had disappeared. It was absolute poppycock. And the individual, who was a distinguished member of the criminal bar, was vilified at great length in the less enlightened sections of the press, and I dare say in the House of Commons, for merely doing his professional duty. But that's one of the crosses we have to bear.